You're listening to NPR on Health. I'm your host, Joe Neal. In this podcast, I've picked out six stories for you. The first is on the obesity epidemic in children and teenagers and how it may have peaked a few years ago. Next, we'll hear about a vaccine for shingles, a very painful disease that's related to chickenpox. Then we'll hear about a new report on counterfeit drugs in the developing world. NPR's John Hamilton will have a brief history of formaldehyde and the current thinking about the risk that it poses. Then we'll hear from NPR's Allison Aubrey on organic farming and the attempt to make fruits and vegetables as nutritious as possible. Finally, we'll have a very brief report on another presidential candidate's health. The medical study that made the most headlines this week was one that showed that the obesity epidemic may have plateaued in teenagers and children. Now, that's good news because it shows that the epidemic seems to have stopped, but it's not all good news because there's still a third of children and teenagers who are overweight or obese and who are at risk for diseases like diabetes and high blood pressure. NPR's Patty Naiman has our report.
In this study, federal health officials figured out the BMI for over 8,000 children and adolescents. The body mass index is a simple calculation of weight to height. It produces a number that rates individuals as normal weight, overweight, or obese. Dr. Reginald Washington says the new study shows the obesity epidemic among children is not getting worse, but it's also not getting better.
That means 32% of the pediatric population is at risk of developing these issues of type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, and all the other issues we see that are related to obesity.
And Washington sees lots of kids with weight-related problems. He's a pediatric cardiologist at the Rocky Mountain Hospital for Children in Denver.
We see children who have type 2 diabetes, and I'm talking about kids under the age of 10, who have type 2 diabetes, who have hypertension or high blood pressure, who have elevations in their cholesterol, some of whom need to go on medications. And we're seeing more and more of those kids where 20 years ago it was almost unheard of to see kids in that age group having these medical issues.
And if one in three kids sounds like an astounding number, says Washington, don't come to his hospital to see the reality. Just go somewhere in your neighborhood.
I would encourage just somebody to go to a local school, park out front, and observe the kids, and you will see that roughly a third of them are overweight or obese. I mean, it's staggering to observe.
Washington says right now the best tool doctors have to identify overweight kids is the BMI. A child may appear to be a healthy weight, but a BMI calculation might prove otherwise. And waiting till kids actually look overweight only makes losing weight more difficult. Measuring kids' BMI is slightly more complicated than measuring adults. For adults, the BMI is an absolute number. If it's over 25, you're overweight. It's more complicated for kids whose weight fluctuates as they grow, which is why a child's BMI is compared to other kids the same age and gender. But Washington says there's another tool that will likely become routine over the next 5 years, a tape measure. In an editorial, pediatric endocrinologist David Ludwig says, similar to adults, measuring a child's waist gives a more accurate prediction of disease risk.
BMI is a very good screening tool, but because it doesn't tell us anything about body composition, that is, the relative amounts of fat versus muscle in the body, at any given BMI, risk for diabetes, heart disease, and other complications can vary greatly according to physical activity level, diet, and a number of other factors, including genetics.
For adults, studies show abdominal fat increases the risk of cardiovascular disease. Evidence suggests the same for children, a good reason to closely monitor a child's weight as they grow. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
I've known a few people who've had shingles. They describe it as being very painful. They're blisters, and it can last for weeks or months. And I just learned the other day, some people have it for the rest of their lives. So the advent of a shingles vaccine last year for people who are over 60 years old is good news. But one thing I also learned last week is that shingles is not just a disease of older adults. It's starting to happen in younger people. NPR's Richard Knox has this report.
Viola Stover's bout of shingles started a few weeks ago. She talked about it yesterday from her backyard in League City, Texas.
It started out with an itching and thought, well, you know, maybe I'm allergic to something. And it just seemed like it got worse and worse.
Then blisters erupted on her back and the pain started.
The pain is like having a jagged knife in your chest and just turning it. I mean, it's the worst pain I think a person could ever go through.
Patients tell doctors the pain of shingles is worse than giving birth, worse than a heart attack. For Stover, the pain brought back memories from childhood.
I watched my grandmother, bless her heart, suffer with it, and I watched my mother suffer. My mom would scream with pain.
In fact, Stover blames her mother's death from alcoholic liver disease on shingles pain that never went away.
My mom detested alcohol. She never allowed it in the house, but my mom was the type, she never would take medication. I know for a fact my mom was hurting so bad that that's why she turned to alcohol.
Dermatologist Stephen Tiering was struck by how often shingles plagued several generations of the same family.
We started asking people, have you had blood relatives with shingles?
That turned into a study at the University of Texas, the first to look at some families' propensity to get shingles. The results appear this month in the Archives of Dermatology. The study continues.
Almost half the patients now have said, yes, I've had a relative or relatives. And we found that if it were a first-degree relative, a parent, sibling, or child, that their chances appear to be about doubled. But if it was, you know, two first-degree relatives, it seemed to be quadrupled.
That's because some people's immune systems are genetically predisposed to shingles. Shingles is a nerve infection caused by the chickenpox virus, varicella zoster. The chickenpox rash goes away, but the virus doesn't. It hides out in nerves in the spine. When immunity dips later in life because of stress, disease, or just normal aging, the virus becomes painfully active again. The incidence of shingles is rising, not just among the elderly, but in younger adults, too.
The theory is, as more and more children get vaccinated against chickenpox, there's less wild-type chickenpox around.
So children don't bring the virus home, and parents and grandparents don't get re-exposed to it. That used to act like a booster shot. Now there's a relatively new vaccine that does the same thing, but very few people have had it. This month, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention urged people over 60 to get it. Merck makes the vaccine. The company is funding some of Dr. Tiering's research in hopes the vaccine will be approved by the FDA for people in their 50s. Meanwhile, Viola Stover is lobbying her friends.
I'm telling everyone to please, for God's sakes, get the vaccine. Because if they don't, they will suffer.
And no, Merck did not pay her to say that. Medicare and private insurers are beginning to cover the vaccine. It costs about $160. Richard Knox, NPR News.
There's a new report out from the World Health Organization about counterfeit drugs. The number of counterfeits being sold in the world has gone up in the past year. Counterfeit drugs can be anything from outright fakes to substandard drugs that, for example, have already expired and shouldn't really be used anymore. The report reinforces another recent study that showed that the campaign against malaria in Africa is suffering because counterfeit drugs are so rampant. NPR's Brenda Wilson has this report.
Globally, the amount of counterfeit medicines has increased by 20%. In 2007, there were more than 1,500 incidents in which bad medicines were detected. These may have been copies of medicines that didn't contain enough of the active ingredient or mislabeled medications. The incidents ranged from finding a single bad pill to a batch of pills in a shipping container. Dr. Valerio Reggi, the head of WHO's anti-counterfeiting task force, says no counterfeiter would manufacture one pill or even a container of pills.
Whatever the quantity that you find, for every drug that you find, it means at least one batch, and one batch usually is between 30 and 60,000 tablets, for example.
Why has it increased? The Internet, the growth in international commerce, and easy access to sophisticated technology. There are inspections, but looking for fakes is like looking for, well, yes, a needle in a haystack.
Finding cases is perfectly casual. It can reflect the bigger number of cases and your better capacity to detect them, or you have one incident that gives you intelligence to find more.
Counterfeits are often found when the medicines don't work as expected. In the worst case, patients die. Too little of, or the lack of, one ingredient in a counterfeited medication can lead to hundreds of deaths. That was a concern of the nonprofit group Africa Fighting Malaria. They wanted to know just how good were anti-malaria drugs in six of Africa's large cities. So they sent a team in to buy some and tested the active ingredients. Amir Attaran of the University of Ottawa says they found problems with the sole remaining effective therapy against malaria, artemisinin.
We find that over a third of the medicines tested didn't make the grade. Probably a large number are counterfeit. We can't say that with certainty, but we know at least that they're substandard, which means they won't treat these patients, they won't treat these children, and save them from a fatal disease.
It's possible they were just not stored properly. Some were being sold years past the expiration date. Africa Fighting Malaria says policies to make medicine more widely available need to be more vigorously monitored by international health organizations. WHO's Reggie says it's not easy for developing countries to keep counterfeit medications off the market.
It's a matter of having the resources, the capacity, and the physical courage to go around the country and identify those unauthorized outlets and do something about that. Very often you need to go with an army of policemen because otherwise your inspectors risk their lives.
The best defense, he says, are stronger regulations on importing, licensing, and selling pharmaceuticals in developing countries. And he calls for campaigns to increase public awareness of the dangers of buying medical products from an unknown source, whether online or at the local market stall. Brenda Wilson, NPR News.
If you've been following the story of the aftermath of Katrina, no doubt you've heard stories about the trailers being contaminated with formaldehyde. Formaldehyde isn't just in the emergency trailers that were put out after Katrina. It's a chemical that's really pervasive in our environment. It's in glue and plywood and plastics and carpet. And as the use of formaldehyde has increased, so have concerns about its safety. We asked NPR's John Hamilton to look into the history of formaldehyde, a chemical that has proved to be incredibly useful and now potentially dangerous.
50 years ago, there wasn't much chance you'd encounter formaldehyde unless you spent time in a laboratory or a funeral home. Ron Wade's family was in the funeral business.
I can remember my father, if he got a cut or something, he would actually pour some formaldehyde on it, thinking it would disinfect, kind of like alcohol.
These days, Wade runs the Anatomical Services Division at the University of Maryland's Medical School. That means he deals with about 1,500 cadavers each year. Wade says he wasn't exactly surprised when studies began showing that formaldehyde was bad for you.
Well, I kind of knew it was hazardous. I mean, when your eyes water and your throat burns and all that, I mean, that's your body telling you that, you know, you probably need to get some fresh air.
Chemists learned how to make formaldehyde in the mid-1800s. One of its earliest uses in the U.S. was to preserve corpses shipped home from the Civil War. But early in this century, industry discovered the chemical could be used to make plastics. And by the 1970s, it was showing up in everything, from foam insulation to construction glue.
I could go into any house and I can find a formaldehyde-releasing product.
Thad Godish is an expert on indoor air quality at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. He says scientists have known for a long time that the chemical could cause health problems.
Formaldehyde is a potent irritant. It's going to irritate the eyes, nose, and throat. And one of the things formaldehyde also causes is fatigue. It just wipes you out. You feel tired all day long. You feel like you haven't got a good night's sleep, and maybe you didn't, because it also interferes with sleep.
It can also cause asthma attacks, and long-term exposure is linked to cancers of the nasal passages and sinuses. Those health problems prompted some government regulation and a bunch of lawsuits. As a result, Godish estimates that between 1980 and 1990, formaldehyde emissions from a typical household product decreased by more than 70%. Nowadays, the formaldehyde in consumer products like glue tends to stay put, except under certain conditions.
You increase the temperature, it starts to break down. You increase the relative humidity, it starts to break down. And if you increase both the temperature and the relative humidity, you have lots of formaldehyde released.
Just the kind of conditions you find along the Gulf of Mexico, where all those FEMA trailers ended up. They were built with plywood and particle board that contained formaldehyde. Godish says the concern about those trailers shows that the issue hasn't gone away. Ron Wade, who preserves corpses with formaldehyde every day, says safety has become a big deal.
This is kind of the office area. And then we go through the double doors, and you have the biohazard, laboratory area, authorized personnel only.
Wade is authorized to work with formaldehyde, and the basement here has a state-of-the-art ventilation system.
You also have respirators that you can wear with organic filters that will take out the vapor.
Do you ever think about how much formaldehyde you've inhaled in your lifetime?
No. I don't think about that.
That's partly because he's much more careful around formaldehyde than he used to be. John Hamilton, NPR News.
If you want to see a video of Ron Wade talking about his ninth grade science fair project, go to our website, npr.org/health. A farming experiment at the University of California, Davis has found that organically grown tomatoes are richer in certain types of antioxidants called flavonoids than conventionally grown tomatoes. NPR's Allison Aubrey visited the farm recently and has this profile of a researcher who's trying to figure out whether organically grown crops are better than conventionally grown foods.
Steve Kafka stumbled upon organic gardening by accident back in the late 1960s when he was a student at UC Santa Cruz. Countercultural, anti-war sentiments were high, and there was word on campus that a bunch of students were digging out a brush-covered hillside for a new organic garden.
My girlfriend dragged me up there. I didn't want to go.
You weren't interested in farming?
No.
But something clicked that day. 40 years later, a framed photo hanging on Kafka's office wall at UC Davis shows him with a wheelbarrow at the center of the activity, running the show. He says he remembers that time well.
Yeah, well, I would have felt wonderful for doing the activity and overwhelmed because I was in charge and too young.
But it was a wonderful time.
Yeah, you could do a thing that was both a craft and intellectually satisfying and was physical.
Kafka went on to get a PhD in agronomy, and one of his latest interests is to figure out if the way we grow things can actually make food more nutritious.
Up here, you have two rows here, it'll probably be about 10,000 plants per acre.
On some fields just west of Davis, California, Kafka and his colleagues have been comparing organic and conventional tomatoes grown in neighboring plots. They've found that the organic ones have almost double the concentration of two types of flavonoids, which are considered to be healthy compounds with potent antioxidant activity. When we visited the site, a tractor was turning over last season's cover crops.
Today's the day.
Good time to be here, huh?
Yeah.
Over the next few days, thousands of seedling tomato plants would be transplanted here, and all of them need nitrogen to grow. Kafka explains a key difference between organic and conventional is how the tomatoes are fertilized. With the conventional plots, Kafka's team applies a commercial fertilizer.
With fertilizer, you can have as much available as you put on.
But with the organic plots, the nitrogen comes from manure and composted cover crops. These have to be broken down by the microbes in the soil before the nitrogen's released.
When you use organic materials like this, it has to go through those breakdown processes. It takes time, and it's not all instantaneously available.
So it's a slower feed?
Yeah.
With less nitrogen, the organic tomatoes may have more time to do things other than just grow, such as to make flavonoids. Kafka's theory is that this difference in how the plants are fertilized may explain why the organic tomatoes, over a 10-year period, contained 97% more camphorol and 79% more quercetin. These are two common flavonoids. It makes for a very interesting finding, especially for those who assume that organic's healthier. But Kafka says it's not so clear-cut.
There's a lot of things when you do these comparisons that can confound the results?
The soil types could be different. Moisture or irrigation may vary from plot to plot, and the variety of tomatoes grown could change the picture.
Just calling something conventional or organic doesn't tell you that.
Kafka says what he's trying to do is pinpoint cause and effect. If limiting the supply of nitrogen to tomatoes could consistently lead to more flavonoids, then perhaps conventional farmers could do this too. But there's much more work to do to test this theory. Kafka's personal views on eating well haven't changed much since he became a researcher. The scientist in him remains skeptical that organic food on the whole is any healthier. But the foodie in him loves to eat here.
This is a combination of a food co-op and a food kind of culture place.
At the Davis Co-op, he cruises past sticky cheeses, specialty meats, and rows of bright-colored produce.
Purple, everything's purple. Purple asparagus.
You eat it all.
Yeah.
I love it all.
Yeah, sure.
Kafka says he's got friends who farm organically, and he likes buying their food to support their way of life.
I think acting in ways that you find consistent with some good principle, how can that be bad?
But he says the research is important, too. It can save us from our biases and help tease apart the consequences of different ways of growing food. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
And finally, a brief report on another presidential candidate's health. If you heard our last podcast, you know that Senator John McCain made his health records available for about 3 hours to a few reporters in a hotel in Scottsdale, Arizona. This week, Senator Barack Obama released a very short summary of his condition. NPR's Joanne Silberner has more.
Internist David Shiner of Chicago has been Obama's physician since 1987. The Obama campaign issued a one-page statement from Shiner. He describes a patient in excellent health who's gotten regular medical attention and who routinely jogs 3 miles. Obama reportedly has a very healthy low blood pressure and heart rate and low cholesterol levels. He's an intermittent smoker, at the moment using a nicotine-based chewing gum. Last week, Senator John McCain allowed reporters a 3-hour peek at 1,100-plus pages of his medical records. So far, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton has not released hers. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
That's it for this podcast. You can hear more health stories by tuning in to your local NPR station. You can find a list of them at npr.org. While you're there, check out more health and science stories by clicking on the link over on the left side of the page. Thanks for listening. I'm Joe Neal, NPR News.